From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It's just not true that the majority of the American public supports the death penalty. Polls have been showing us for 10 years when you give people the alternative of imprisonment as an alternative in the question, it drops to 50% or below. We just are beginning to experience a significant shift in American public opinion about the death penalty now because of the 89 innocent people who have come off of death row.
Today, Sister Helen Prejean delivers more than 3 million signatures to the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. She joins us in the studio for a conversation about the death penalty. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect George W. Bush made four key appointments over the weekend, naming General Colin Powell as Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice as National Security Advisor, Alberto Gonzalez as White House Counsel, and Karen Hughes as Counselor to the President. Reading from David Plotz's article in Slate Online Magazine, talking about Colin Powell's career, he says, Powell's military career testifies to his skills as a bureaucratic infighter. He had 1 year of real combat, a nasty stint as a Vietnam advisor, but mostly he was a staff officer, planning and advising superiors on strategy and logistics. Powell was great at getting along, Plotz writes, in a 1968-69 tour of Vietnam. He served as a staff officer in the division that committed the My Lai massacre. He arrived in Vietnam after the massacre occurred, but before it was discovered. As Charles Lane chronicled in the New Republic, Powell made no aggressive effort to investigate war crimes when he was asked to look into them, and he brushed off a soldier who had complained. According to Lane, Powell also kept his head down as a White House fellow during Watergate. When Powell worked for Ronald Reagan's National Security Council, he objected quietly to the Iran-Contra arms for hostages deal, but then helped Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger arrange the dubious transfer of missiles to Iran. In 1987 deposition, Powell said Weinberger did not keep a diary or detailed notes of his daily activities during the Iran-Contra deal, but 5 years later, in a sworn affidavit, Powell recalled that Weinberger did indeed keep contemporaneous daily notes that Powell characterized as, quote, a personal diary which reflected a record of his life. The appointment of Colin Powell means that two of the most powerful positions in the country, Secretary of State and the Vice Presidency, will be headed by men deeply involved in the Pentagon. Dick Cheney, the Vice President, was former Secretary of Defense, and Colin Powell, a general and head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll take a look at the significance of Colin Powell's appointment. In other news related to Colin Powell's appointment, he said in his acceptance speech that he would be taking a hard line on Iraq. Quote, Saddam Hussein is sitting on a failed regime that is not going to be around in a few years' time, said the retired Army general. Of the sanctions imposed after the Gulf War, Powell said, I think it is possible to re-energize those sanctions and to continue to contain him and then confront him should that become necessary again. Critics of the UN-US sanctions against Iraq have called them genocidal, citing UN statistics that show that up to 5,000 children a month die as a result of those sanctions. An Iraqi government newspaper today fiercely attacked U.S. President-elect George Bush's and Secretary of State-designate Colin Powell's comments on Iraq. They called Powell a Gulf War criminal. Meanwhile, the top advisors to Bush declared yesterday that there would be no retreat from his conservative policy agenda, denying Bush's presidency would be weakened by the narrowness of his victory. Vice President-elect Dick Cheney said the new administration would seek support from wherever it could in pursuing the agenda outlined by the Texas governor. The massive $1.3 trillion across-the-board tax cut opposed by Democrats for benefiting the wealthy at the expense of the middle class would remain the top priority. However, Republican leaders in Congress are advising Bush to start with smaller, more attainable tax cuts, such as repealing inheritance taxes. Italian riot police fired tear gas late Saturday to dispel thousands of demonstrators protesting a meeting between Pope John Paul II and Austrian far-right leader Horst Haider, who helped light the Vatican's Christmas tree. The weekend riot near St. Peter's Square, one of the most violent confrontations in John Paul's 22-year papacy, was the culmination of 4 days of political fireworks leading up to the visit by Haider, who has praised Hitler's policies in the past. On the weekend, he characterized Italy's respected president as a typical leftist and chided Italy for what he called lax immigration policies. And that's some of the news at this hour.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold, the ark of his testament is stowed, a throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire, and God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb, my head is shaved, my head is wired, and like a moth that tries to enter the bright eye, I go shuffling out of life just to hide in death a while. And anyway, I never lie. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is burning, and I think my head is glowing, and in a way I'm hoping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway there was no proof, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is glowing, and I think my head is smoking, and in a way I'm hoping to be done with all these looks of disbelief. A life for a life and a truth for a truth, and I've got nothing left to lose, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is smoking, and I think my head is melting, and in a way that's helping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, but I'm afraid I told a lie.
Johnny Cash singing The Mercy Seat here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! About the death penalty and execution in the United States. Today, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan will be presented with close to 3.5 million signatures of people around the world who are calling for a moratorium on the death penalty. Among those who will be presenting that petition is Sister Helen Prejean. She'll be speaking at a rally today at Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza, which is across the street from the United Nations. And she is the woman who, perhaps more than any other in this country, have made the death penalty a national issue. She is a Catholic nun who began her work on the death penalty in 1984 when she accompanied one man on his journey to the electric chair. Her book, Dead Man Walking, was made into an Academy Award-winning movie starring Susan Sarandon that was produced by Tim Robbins. We'll also be joined by William Nieves, who's the 89th innocent person to come off of death row. He, too, will be at the United Nations today delivering those signatures. We're spending the hour with Sister Helen Prejean. Welcome to Democracy
Now! I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Amy.
Well, your words have become famous around the world. Your work began in the 1980s. Can you tell us how you started?
Yeah, I mean, the simple and direct answer of how I got involved with the death penalty is that I got involved with poor people in New Orleans, moved into the St. Thomas housing projects. Once I moved from the suburbs and the world that that represents, of who you have lunch with, of who you share your consciousness with every day, and moved into the St. Thomas housing projects where the violence was there and the racism and police routinely stopping young black men, I watched for the first time what police brutality meant, watched what it meant to have a policy in the city that drugs could be open in a St. Thomas housing project, but there'd be a war against drugs if it moved out to the suburbs. Watched even seeing the blood on the sidewalk of people being killed, and watching people coming into Hope House where I was working who had been through 11 grades in the New Orleans public schools, and they couldn't read at a third grade level, and they couldn't do the simplest fractions in math. And then getting in touch with my own privilege that I had had a father was a lawyer, that I'd gone to private schools, that I had been educated, that by the time I was a senior in high school, I knew how to do public speaking, had a sense of self-confidence in what I could do. And then I'm going, why me? Why was I given all that? And I began to see the systemic way that poverty and racism works against people. And then I was asked one day by a friend to write a letter to somebody on death row. I didn't know much about the death penalty at all, but I knew this. If they were sitting on death row in Louisiana, they were poor. I was there to serve poor people. I was enough to get started. I wrote the man a letter. It was 1982. Never dreamed they were going to execute him. He hadn't executed anybody in Louisiana since the 60s. And then I walked with him to the electric chair on the night of April 5th, 1984, and I could never be the same again.
Who was he?
Patrick Saunier was his name. Wrote about him in Dead Man Walking. A Cajun from around Acadiana in Louisiana, St. Martinville, New Iberia, Lafayette, all those little cities. He and his brother, Eddie Saunier, had abducted a teenage couple and raped the girl and killed the couple. Although as the truth came out, see, my daddy was a lawyer, I really thought in the United States they would have gotten good defense. As the truth came out, the truth was that Eddie, the brother who got life, was the one who killed the kids. Patrick Saunier was executed for it. And that was my first awakening to the death penalty and how it worked. And so I began to learn a lot. Only poor people are selected for the death penalty. Overwhelmingly, people who kill white people are selected for the death penalty. Though 50% of all the homicide victims in this country are people of color. But it's a predominantly white criminal justice system, judges, prosecutors. And it's when white people are killed. 8 out of every 10 people who sit on death row cells are there because they kill white people. And I learned when I lived in the St. Thomas Projects, when people in St. Thomas Projects were killed, sometimes you couldn't even find 3 lines in the paper about their death, that there's a difference in the way we treat certain victims, though we claim the death penalty is to do justice for victims. We're not talking about most victims of homicide in this country. I began to learn all these things about the death penalty, and then I began to speak out. I began to give talks. I began to write, and then it led me to write the book. Dead Man Walking, in which I just take people with me through the journey I made, because I started out not knowing anything about the death penalty, and a lot of people in this country don't reflect a lot about the death penalty, are outraged over crimes, just on the surface just say, whoever did that, well, they deserve to die. Most people don't even realize that there are 17,000 homicides in this country every year, and 1.5% of those people that do those homicides are going to be chosen for death. And you look at who's chosen, those that kill white people, always poor people, and a disproportionate number of people of color. In the federal death penalty, 19 have been condemned to death, and 16 of them are people of color.
We're talking to Sister Helen Prejean, who is in New York, though she works in Louisiana, in New York to deliver 3.5 million signatures to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Why Kofi Annan?
It's a symbolic way of bringing the United States into the rest of the world, where now we have 123 countries in the world that have, in law practice, don't have the death penalty. United States is the only Western industrialized country in the world that still has a death penalty. And so this is a way for us to begin to get on board with the other countries of the world. So it's a symbolic way of holding up our country, and also to begin to show to the American people the mounting wave of opposition to the death penalty. For example, in the Moratorium Office, Moratorium 2000 Office, we have a web page, www.moratorium2000.org. And a month and a half ago, we had 100,000 signatures. Now, in a month and a half time, we have 300,000 signatures you can sign online. And it just shows, as the word spreads, people, we've been going down this death road of the death penalty since the Gregg decision in 1976, when the Supreme Court said that we could do away with the arbitrariness and capriciousness of the death penalty, and they set up certain guidelines to eliminate that arbitrariness and capriciousness. There is no way that the death penalty does not continue to be arbitrary and capricious. And following the pattern which I just stated, it's as arbitrary and capricious as it was in 72 when the Supreme Court overturned it in Furman. But now the difference is, in the American public, close to 20 years going down this road, they are beginning to recognize that the death penalty, with all these innocent people coming off a death row, 89 innocent people, our sense of decency and fairness of who we are as a people has been offended.
Let's go right now to the 89th person to be released from death row. He's in New York today as well to deliver those petitions to Kofi Annan. His name is William Nieves. He was in prison for 8 years in Pennsylvania, served 6 years on death row. Welcome to Democracy Now!, William Nieves.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Tell us when you were released.
I was released on October the 23rd, 2000, recently.
And tell us what happened.
In 1993, I was arrested for committing the killing of a 21-year-old young African-American in the Philadelphia section of Pennsylvania. And this male was shot down in front of his house 3 days prior to Christmas on December the 22nd of 1992. A year later, I was arrested for committing this crime. In 1994, during the summer month of July, I was convicted and sentenced to death. The motive for the killing was drug-related. I fit the profile, being a Hispanic male, living in the Philadelphia ghettos of Latinos and African Americans. After pursuing a direct appeal 6 years later, on February 17th of 2000, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court awarded me a new trial on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. when we began the retrial, new counsel discovered that there was an eyewitness to the shooting who originally told the police during one of the proceedings in the first trial that I was not the person who he seen shoot his friend and brother of the sister who he was dating at the time of the murder. After hearing this new evidence, the jury believed him and decided to find me not guilty on all charges.
And yet you had served 6 years on death row.
Correct. And what's so outrageous about it is that the prosecutor knew the identity of this eyewitness. The police knew of the identity of this eyewitness. They both spoke to this eyewitness previously, prior to the first trial. And yet they were willing to oppose a new trial and continue to conceal the identity of this eyewitness who apparently exonerated me.
If you had been denied the retrial, a warrant for your execution would have been signed in 30 days. We're talking to William Nieves, number 89, 89 people released from death row. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll continue with William Nieves and sister Helen Prejean. This a particularly key issue today as a new president begins to assemble his cabinet, will take office and towards the end of January. A man who has presided over more executions as governor of his state, Texas, than any other in U.S. history. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll be looking at the appointment of Colin Powell as Secretary of State, with General Powell as Secretary of State and Dick Cheney as the Vice President-elect. You've got in the top four most powerful positions in this country two men deeply involved with the military, Dick Cheney, former head of the Pentagon, and of course Colin Powell, the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What does this mean in this country for foreign policy? These are the issues we'll be raising tomorrow. Today, we're going to talk about what some call an extension of the military-industrial complex in this country, and there is a growing movement against it. We're going to talk about the death penalty today for the rest of the program as we continue with Sister Helen Prejean, who has made it her life's work to both accompany people on death row to their executions. She must wince at that description, and also let people know around the country and the world what that experience is like. We're also joined on the telephone by William Nieves, who has been released from death row. They both are in New York to deliver more than 3 million petitions to the UN Secretary General calling for a moratorium against the death penalty. Sister Helen Prejean, you actually not only accompany people on death row, but you have worked with victims' families.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yes, and that really helped me to learn about the death penalty, too. We started Survive in New Orleans, a murder victim support group, made up mainly of African-American women who had lost sons. Shirley Carr had lost two sons within 6 months to violence, and that was when I discovered how racist the death penalty was, because of the 40 women in the group who had lost loved ones to violence. Not only was the death penalty not sought in any of the murders, but they never even came to trial in any of these 40 women. I have accompanied murder victims' families. Politicians try to legitimize the death penalty in two ways, and George Pataki did that when he ran as governor of New York. They try to legitimize it by calling it a deterrent. In other words, I'm not for selective vengeance of a few people. This is a deterrent. It has a salutary effect in our society, which, of course, we know it's not. And the other is justice for victims' families. I have accompanied victims' families who could not wait to see the person be executed, who called their own press conference a week before his execution saying they wanted to see the smoke fly from his body. They're going to sit on the front row. They wish they could pull the switch. And when we reflect on what people are suffering who have lost a loved one and have the state approach them, who doesn't understand that that's their pain talking? And who of us could say that we wouldn't at least go through those feelings of saying we would want to see that done to someone who killed our loved one? But what has been interesting to me is to see what happens to people afterwards, even when they could watch the execution. And then, and I wrote about them in Dead Man Walking, to come out after the execution. This is the Harveys I'm talking about, whose daughter Faith had been killed, brutally killed. And they watched the man, Robert Lee Willie, die in the electric chair. They came out, all the media's waiting for him, and said, well, you finally got your chance to see Willie die. How do you feel now? And Vernon Harvey stepped up to the mic and said, the SOB died too quick. I hope he burns in hell. And I realized they could have watched him die if there was a way to do this every week. But the chair at the dining room table was always going to be empty where his child sat. That's a false formula. You watch another person die, and that's going to give you closure. That's going to give you healing. And then you got to remember what a small percentage of these so-called victims' families you're getting justice for. 17,000 homicides, 1.5% of people chosen to die who kill people. That means 98% of victims' families never get this so-called justice. What heals a human heart after such a terrible loss? We have incredible witnesses among us. Marietta Yeager, whose daughter was killed. Bud Welch, whose daughter Julie was in the Oklahoma City bombing. And they choose another road, which is, we know that watching another human being die is never going to heal us. And they seek the road of reconciliation and forgiveness.
And now Timothy McVeigh has called for his execution date to be set.
His suicide. And the state of Oklahoma will be glad to oblige him in that. One of the things that I've learned in these 15 years of being with people is the mental pressure and stress on people who are waiting to die, preparing to die, trying to do it with as much dignity as they can muster. You have to be so mentally strong to face it. And we have a growing number of consensual executions. Timothy McVeigh is the latest of them.
Dead Man Walking, that term, the name of your book, the name of the movie, where does it come from?
The guards at San Quentin, this was back in the 40s, when a man would come out of his death row cell onto the tier, they would announce his presence by saying, Dead Man Walking. And that's why I chose it for the title of the book.
William Yeves, you were on death row for 6 years. Did you ever hear that term used?
Excuse me, what was that term again?
Dead Man Walking.
Yes, I remember the movie, and I remember the guys speaking about the book. And
But in your experience on death row, did the guards refer to you as Dead Man Walking?
No, They kind of took it as a laughing term, but no, they never used that term.
Sister Helen Prejean, when you were speaking earlier, you talked about a man just being moved from one prison to another, or one area.
Well, a man on death row at Huntsville in Texas, who had to go to another part of the prison for some kind of hearing or something, and when he walked through the corridor, they made the prisoners in that section of prison turn their backs to him and face the wall, and the guard said, "Dead man walking." That was just a few years ago, and so sometimes it is still used.
President-elect George Bush has presided over more executions as governor of Texas than any governor in the history of this country. Al Gore, in his race for the presidency, also reiterated his support for the death penalty, particularly when Chaka Sankofa, Gary Graham, was executed in Texas, when hundreds of people gathered to say that they believe that this man was innocent. And on Election Day, we got a chance to question President Clinton about the death penalty. I'd like to get your response to what President Clinton had to say. And finally, do you support a moratorium on the death penalty, given the studies that show how racist it has been, how it has been applied?
I think I certainly support what the governor of Illinois did, because there was clear evidence in Illinois that a lot of mistakes had been made. In the case of the federal government, I have asked the Attorney General to conduct a comprehensive review and to let me and to report back to us on the racial disparities and on any question of guilt, on adequate assistance of counsel, on all those things to determine whether there should be a moratorium. And I haven't gotten her findings yet. Now, so far, the only two cases which have come up have been deferred while we do this study. And so when that comes in, and if it comes in while I'm still in office, then I'll make a judgment. And if it doesn't, I think that the next president, I would hope, would make the same decision based on the merits, based on what the evidence shows. The disturbing thing to me is that there's not only an apparent racial disparity on death row, but also in the federal government, but also way over half the cases come from a relatively small number of the U.S. attorney's offices, which is, you know, it's disturbing. But again, let me just say this. If you're concerned about that, that's a good reason to vote for Al Gore and Joe Lieberman and Hillary for the Senate, and for the people in New Jersey who can hear you, for John Corzine, because we know the Democrats care about these issues, and we know they're not very important to the Republicans. And
Vice
so
President
that's another example of another reason you ought to vote for the Democrats.
Gore supports the death penalty.
He does, but...
And Lieberman.
Yes, they do. But there's a difference in supporting it and thinking that you would carry it out even if you thought the system was fundamentally unfair. His opponent...
But
the studies are not complete, because the studies have to... What the Attorney General is doing is not just looking at everybody that's been convicted, but everybody that could have been charged that wasn't. There's a lot more stuff that needs to be done, and it may confirm the initial view of who's on the death row. But I think what you ought to look at that as compared with Texas, for example, where there was evidence that lawyers falling asleep in their trials were not enough to deter Texas from continuing to carry out the death penalty, which I thought was unacceptable. And so I think that if you're interested in having somebody that at least has the capacity to look at the fairness of this, you only have one choice.
Well, I guess many people were quite disturbed that when you first ran for president, you went back in the midst of your campaign to Arkansas and presided over the execution of a mentally impaired man.
Yeah, but let's go back to the facts here. He was not mentally impaired when he committed the crime. He became mentally impaired because he was wounded after he murdered somebody. And the law says that it's your mental state at the time you committed the crime. That's something no one ever says that when they talk about it. Had he been mentally impaired when he committed the crime, I would never have carried out the death penalty, because he was not in a position to know what he was doing. That is not what the facts were. Secondly, if I had not gone home, I would have been accused of putting a tough decision off on somybody else.
President Clinton talking about the death penalty on Election Day and why voters should go out and support the Democrats like Vice President Al Gore when asked about the issue of the racist application of the death penalty, even though Al Gore supports the death penalty. Sister Helen Prejean, your response.
Here we go. We're at a new point here in terms of, you listen to what Clinton said. He said if they didn't get effectiveness at counsel, if there's basic systematic things wrong with the death penalty, we got to move to this new ground to help the Al Gores get on it, to help everybody get on it. Al Gore said he supported the death penalty. It's like picture two doors closed. But what's going on behind the door? Some are more troubled by the death penalty than others are. And we got to move into that new ground. Notice what Clinton said about effectiveness of counsel. The reason we can't fix the death penalty and make it fair so that it observes due process and equal protection under the law is because poor people are selected for the death penalty and they get poor defense. And that's why innocent people go on to death row along with the guilty. We got to help people in both parties see this and see that the American public, they no longer have a mandate from the American public to carry out the death penalty. And it's our job, those of us who work with this issue, to show people how systemic the flaws are in this. Texas, where George W. Bush says, oh, but we're in Illinois, freed 13 people. Oh, but we don't have problems in Texas. Who's on death row in Texas? Poor people, overwhelmingly people who've killed white people. It's as racist as you can imagine. It has all the systemic problems in it that Illinois has. And all the states have the same systemic problem. A lawyer going to sleep at a trial is the least of the problems because so many of them don't have the resources for forensic evidence, expert witnesses, really putting on a good defense so that innocent people go to death row along with the guilty. What's the ground that decent Americans can stand on, the people and politicians? We are doing something in this country that goes against who we are fundamentally as a people. We're going against due process, equal protection of the law. We're going against our own Constitution in executing innocent people.
President Clinton said the studies are still not complete that prove the discrimination against people who are poor or color.
He knows the discrimination's in there because when you got 19 people condemned and you got 16 people of color. But notice the other thing he said. It's disturbing to me that it's coming from certain judicial districts, right? Certain attorney generals push for the death penalty, others don't in these federal districts. Janet Reno expressed the same concern. One of the things that's going to make us undo the death penalty is you realize DA's offices at the state level have complete discretionary power. So here we are in a DA's office. Like, look what happened to William Nieves, okay? They needed to get somebody. They get William Nieves. They know that here's an eyewitness saying it was somebody else. But they've thrown down the gauntlet. They've got their person. They're under pressure to get people for these crimes, right? And so prosecutorial misconduct is one of the reasons why a lot of innocent people are on death row. And look, and that happens all across the country.
William Nieves, what was your counsel like? What was your legal representation like?
In my opinion, very poor to compare to the quality of effective counsel that I received during the retrial. I'd like to mention that first counsel who represented me never represented a capital case in his entire career. He was only paid $2,500 to represent me. He received no funds to hire an investigator. He did no investigation on his own. The trial, including the penalty phase hearing, lasted a total of 3 days. That's unacceptable in a capital case when there is so much information available to a lawyer to hire an investigator instead of relying on the prosecutor's own evidence.
You were on death row for 6 years in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
You were on the same death row that Mumia Abu-Jamal
is?
No, I was at SEI Pittsburgh. Mumia was at SEI Green. In fact, I did see Mumia Saturday morning. I couldn't stop to talk to him because he had a visitor in his visiting room. But I was able to view him and seeing that he was partaking in the in the visiting the bus trip that we had took to 45 family members of death row prisoners in Pennsylvania through the Pennsylvania abolitionists.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for being with us, William Nieves. Again, he is one of many who are in New York today. He and Sister Helen Prejean, Susan Sarandon, and a number of other people will be delivering a petition of more than 3.5 million names to the UN Secretary General calling for a moratorium on the death penalty. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Sister Helen Prejean. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we're joined by Sister Helen Prejean, who has been fighting for against the death penalty in this country for the last, well, close to two decades. How many people have you accompanied on death row to the execution chamber?
Five. I'm with the sixth person now, Manuel Ortiz, who's from El Salvador and whom I believe to be innocent right now in Louisiana.
And what is it like that last day? Describe, you talk about the first time.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, going into a death house to wait with somebody who's about to die is the most surreal experience I ever had in my life. Because all the signals around you are signals of life. Floors polished, the coffee pots percolating, the somebody's typing up the witnesses' forms. You can hear the typewriter going. And what are the witnesses' forms? Well, these are going to be the people who, after they have witnessed you die, are going to sign these papers. But you hear people coming in and out. You hear the buzz of human voices. I kept falling back on the feeling that I was in a hospital. They're following this protocol. Everybody's polite. In Louisiana, they're really polite. I mean, they make a big deal of the last meal. You want fried shrimp, crawfish etouffee. Food's a big thing. And it kept throwing me because I was going, the end of this process is not going to be that they're going to kill this perfectly healthy man. It can't be that he's going to die. And then you tick off the hours. Time is like no other time. Time is racing and time is standing still. And then it's 10 o'clock. Then the guards are coming in to get his body ready. Then it was electrocution, so to shave his hair, shave his eyebrows, cut off the pants leg, left pants leg of his pants, and shave around the calf of his leg where they're going to put the electrode, put a clean white T-shirt on him. Look at the cleanliness that's in this thing. Now gurneys look like hospital gurneys, and they put alcohol on your arm before they inject the lethal drugs into your body. And then the next thing I know, there's the warden, there's the strap-down team saying, time to go, Sonia. And we're beginning to walk toward the electric chair. And he says to the warden, warden, can Sister Helen touch my arm? I mean, the film Dead Man Walking really captured this. And it was the first time I touched him and then walked with him. And then you look, there's this room. There's a big clock on the wall. There's the exhaust fan turned on to pull out the stench of burning flesh when his body was going to burn. There are all the 12 specially chosen witnesses there behind a plexiglass to protect them from the smell of burning flesh. And there he is saying his last words. And there's this scripted death happening in front of my eyes. And then there he is looking at me from the electric chair before he dies. And then they kill him. It's the most unreal thing I ever saw. And when I came out, I was traumatized. I threw up, but then I knew I had been a witness. Few people are getting to see this. They don't know what it is. And so then I began to speak out to whoever would listen. Then I began to write, and that led to the book.
You talked about few people get to see this. So you were a witness to something that is, in fact, not allowed to be seen, but is done in all of our names.
By design, it is secret. What would happen if we had the uncontrolled gaze of the public seeing this? What if a family sitting down for dinner in the evening, and on the TV, the kids say, well, who's that, Mama? And they see a man being strapped on a gurney, and you hear his last words. It's by design that the American public is not watching the death penalty. Our own warden at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, who carries out the death penalty, has a great costliness for him. He says, why don't they make this public? Why don't these politicians who give all the great speeches about why we need this, why aren't they here? We're the ones that got to do this. Let them come close. Let the people see this, and they'll reject this thing.
What about the men and women who are part of the execution protocol?
Oh, more and more stories are coming. I told a story of a man in Louisiana, Felton Cootie, who was a supervisor at death row and was part of the strap-down team in Louisiana. He called me in his office one day. He said, look, sister, he says, I know some of these guys have done terrible crime. I know all of them on death row. He said, I don't condone what they did, but when you're close to it like this, I come home after these executions, and he didn't even strap a leg or an arm or a trunk down to the chair or the gurney. His job was just to take a paper sack after they were executed, go into the cell, get their toothbrush, get their soap, get their stuff to give to their family. And he said, I can't do it anymore. I sit in my easy board chair. I can't eat. I can't sleep. In my gut, I know I'm helping to kill a person who's defenseless. And we are doing just what they did, and I can't do it anymore.
What do you mean we're doing just what they did?
We're killing them. And through a protocol, premeditation, and then killing someone who's been rendered defenseless. Plus, he also saw, and a number of the guards at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, I've been going there for over 15 years, a lot of them know me, and they talk to me. They say, you know, the guy we killed tonight is so different from that young, brash animal that came through the door, because he's had these years to read books and to meditate and to change, and then we kill him. I mean, the guards themselves who participate in this can see this, and they know. So that's why I wrote a book, and that's why I do like 20 speaking engagements a month all over this country. And I bring people there through these stories because people are like, they got on three sets of gloves.
What about this issue of the people of this country cited over and over that they support this?
Nah, it's not true. In fact, we've been knowing this for 10 years. When in the question about the death penalty, you give people the alternative of life imprisonment, support drops to 50%. Within the last 2 years, Even when the question's asked in the abstract, do you support the death penalty, it's dropped 20 points. 64% of the American public now support a moratorium on the death penalty. I know this from talking to all these people across this country. The American people are good and decent people, but they've been removed from this issue. They haven't had a way of being brought close to say, what are we doing here as a country? They don't know how racist it is. They don't know. I mean, some polls show that. You bring them close and say, look, we got an alternative waiting for us tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. We don't have to keep doing this. Look at the small percentage of people who have chosen to die anyway.
We're seeing growing social justice movements in this country against the prison industrial complex, against the death penalty. I mean, do you feel there's progress being made at this point? Our next president, as we said, you know, has presided over more executions than any governor in U.S. history, says it's a deterrent. What about police around the country? Did they echo these terms?
Well, being it's a interesting deterrent? When the police chiefs were asked. They were given 10 ways to combat crime. They all put the death penalty dead last because they know violence erupts out of lives of chaos, often laced with alcohol and drugs. There's no forethought or thinking of consequences. They know the death penalty doesn't deter anybody from doing crime. That's just one example.
And what about President-elect Bush? He'll become president, and then what about the judicial system in this country?
Yeah, no, that's very serious about the – I mean, what the courts already have done and what Congress did in the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act by stripping habeas, stripping the appeals. Before then, the track record was that over 40% of federal appeals overturned what the state courts had done. Now they're not doing that anymore. They're just railroading it through on a greased rail to expedite executions. See, the death penalty is not a peripheral issue about what to do about a few, in quotes, terrible criminals. The death penalty hits at the core of who we are as a society, and every one of our deepest wounds is in it. Racism is in it. Our assault on the poor and picking poor people to be the ones to die is in it, and our penchant for trying to solve social problems with military solutions is in it. The death penalty is one more military solution. Target an enemy, demonize the enemy, terminate the enemy, and that's in the death penalty.
It's very interesting you raise this issue of something like, what, 1% of murders in this country a result in the death penalty.
1.5%.
When I was down in Huntsville, the capital of punishment in the Western world, I was asking shopkeepers around the prison what they think about death penalty. And, you know, each one said, eye for an eye. You know, if you're going to kill someone, you have to expect this. And I asked, well, what do you think of the fact that in only something like 1% of the cases does someone get the death penalty? So who determines who gets it and who doesn't? What determines this?
Yeah. But you know how Clinton was talking about, just it comes from certain judicial districts. Here you got in Harris County in Texas, 1/4 of all the executions come from Johnny Holmes, who cuts a notch in his belt, goes for the death penalty every chance he gets. You can point out the centers where certain district attorneys go for the death penalty. Right down the road from them will be a district attorney who never goes for the death penalty. So you have these pockets where certain people go for it and they don't. There's no way to make this thing to do away with the arbitrariness and capriciousness in it because you have discretionary from a DA. They have discretionary power whether they go for it or not. And that's present in this system too. 1%. Look at New York State. 5 years ago, you put the death penalty back here in New York. Where are you now? New York has spent $80 million. They've been through 200 possible capital cases, and they got 6, and I'm going to call them trophies, political symbols on death row. Think what New York could have done with that $80 million. And any time you zero in on the death penalty, you see it's extremely costly. DAs call it the Cadillac of the criminal justice system. You put 6-8 times the amount of money going for a capital case. And then for what? Look at New York. 6 people, 5 years, $80 million. Selective process.
Given your religious beliefs that this is state-sanctioned murder, and the fact that you accompany people on death row to the death chamber, what has stopped you from, well, hurling your body in front of the dead man walking when the guards are walking him to the chamber?
Yeah. One of the things that stops me from doing that is that I know that I can accompany people and give them dignity, help them shore up their dignity, even as I resist their death. And I know that it's a physical act that wouldn't accomplish anything in terms of actually saving them and would keep me then from being able to accompany other people. But see, it's tricky because you do not want to be an accomplice by being a witness. And I make very clear when I'm witnessing an execution in Louisiana, I am not your witness. I am there to be for him so he can look at me. And the minute I step out of the gates of that prison, they know that I'm speaking to people and that I'm working to change the death penalty with every ounce of strength I have in my body.
If you had an audience with the president-select, George Bush, what would you say to him?
I'd try to give him a graceful way. I'd say, look, President Bush, you claimed in the debates it was a deterrence. And yet, while you ran for president of the United States, you made sure there was only one execution a month in your state. If you really believe it's a deterrence, why didn't you speed up? Just let the executions go at their regular rate in your state, which is at least four a month. Why did you slow it down? Look, where's the mandate from the American public to do this? The fact is that things have shifted. We don't need to do this anymore. Governing by crime is not what's really going to help us as a society. What we need to do is address the root solutions to our violence, the at-risk kids, the public schools. These are the things that really make it for people to have living wages when they go to work. And I would appeal to him in that. We don't need to do this anymore. We've been down a death road. Where has it brought us? It goes against the deepest grain of who we are in American people and in our Constitution.
1,100 city councils have signed on to this petition that's going to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan today. City councils in this country.
Yes, and growing every day. I mean, there were 15 alone in North Carolina going before New York city council tomorrow. I will have a chance to address them on. They're doing a moratorium on the death penalty as well. And what does this say to us? It's just a growing number of people in the country recognizing we don't want to go down this road anymore. We don't have to go down this road anymore. And let's put all these resources where they really count in dealing with the roots of violence.
We've come to the end of the program. If people want to find out more about this moratorium project, you've got 3.5 million signatures that are going to Kofi Annan. Is that
right?
The end
and the web page. You can sign online and you can give the names of your friends. www.moratorium2000.org.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sister Helen Prejean. She's written the book Dead Man Walking, on which the Hollywood film was based. Susan Sarandon won an Academy Award for her performance, for her embodying Sister Helen Prejean. We've got the real thing in the studio today. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Annie. It's great.
If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow we'll take a look at General Colin Powell. He's the next Secretary of State. It's Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Matthew Fincher, engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
That brings us to the end of the program. Jennifer Harbury and Bruce Ellison, attorneys for Leonard Peltier, James Burris, and John Sennett with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, Terry Allen, and Chris Abrams. Matthew Finch, our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.